Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
And her faithful sidekick, again.
Kate.
Just me.
Welcome to Med Crimes.
She's the hot one today. I didn't even put on makeup. This is a lot.
We're comparison, though, mm-hmm. Because I said she was skinnier, so it's fine. It's a balance.
It's all about balance.
It's a balance. If you put us two together, you'd be skinny, hot Devon Kate.
Devon Kate. As a unit, it works. Yes. Separately, not so much, right?
Separately, they each got some stuff to work on.
Oh, we're psyched to be back.
Here we are, every other Tuesday.
Pot two. Yes. Of this whole, actually, very kind of like psychotic case that.
So, y'all,
relax.
Speaking of psychotic case,
everyone relax.
We're not psychotic.
No,
I think those of you that have listened to us from the beginning, maybe we're good about it, and some of the newbies were not so good about it. But like, trust us.
Yeah.
Like,
it's fine.
There's a reason why things are in parts.
Yes.
You cannot judge
exactly
based off of a half. Look at us. Together, collectively, we work.
A unit, you guys. It's
right?
A unit.
It's a unit. So by the end of part three, you will understand. So we did. Go ahead, Kate. You want to?
I mean, so I will admit that when I had just watched the documentary, I did come out of that with a narrative, which is mm-hmm. exactly the goal of the documentary. Because.
Correct.
And the fact that I kept referencing it, I think, made some people kind of question if we had researched even further into this. We had, and we have, and
which we always do.
I'm going to make an effort to sound a little bit less biased this time around, because I think it did come off a little biased, because maybe I was feeling some type of way about the whole thing. And to be honest, I don't really know what to believe. And you guys can make your own decision and assumption about that. When you've heard all of the information, there are a lot of things that were not in the documentary that really do change the narrative a little bit.
Which, hello, I mean, that's what happens when you do a documentary. You know, you're doing it out there to set a picture.
Netflix partnered with the family. So we are getting the
picture,
family's
right,
perspective.
Exactly. And that happens with a lot of things
yeah.
in the nature of what we do. Like, I talked about the documentary Dear Zachary. When
exactly.
I was talking about Dr. Andrew Bagby's death.
Exactly.
And so, but it's like, you know, you get that as
there's
like
more,
a
though.
Basis, a summary,
yeah.
but then you research further beyond.
Exactly.
To really get the details.
Exactly.
And, you know, that tends to happen with a lot of what we do.
It does, yeah. So I am going to keep kind of referencing back to the documentary a little bit, because I think it's important to get their side. And it does
and
really
plus,
help with timelines and
if you guys, it's also like, you know, sometimes people hear what we talk about and then they're like, man, I want to watch that or I want to
exactly.
see that. And so like, you know, we tell you how to find it.
Exactly.
You know? But again, knowing that it's just one side.
Exactly.
We're your girls. We're nurses.
Yeah, dude.
We get you back.
Yeah.
This is going to be a heavy debate. I think this is, and it reminds
yes.
me of when we were talking about, for you guys to kind of compare too, Kate and I really struggled when we were discussing Radon DeVos.
Yes, 100%.
Because we were like,
we see both sides.
We see what she did.
Yes.
But is it criminal? You know, so
yes.
it's just like, and we had that whole debate.
We have that
forth.
Discussion. This is going to be a back and forth also, because, you know, the I'm going to be playing devil's advocate here. And there's a lot of repercussions within this lawsuit. And a lot of the healthcare community is sort of up in arms about what that means. And we will get into that more so in part three, but I'll mention it here too.
Again, you got to go through each part of the story.
Exactly. So anyway.
Bear with us.
Bear with us. Thank you for bearing with us. And thank you for joining us for part two. So we'll go over
to our friends.
All of these details. Yeah.
So we wanted to preface that first. Then
yes.
we won't forget about our new friends.
How could I possibly?
How could we forget?
Patreons. We have Suzanne.
Just Suzanne.
You know, I love the Madonna thing when people
I
do that.
It.
I just think it's like sexy as hell. So Suzanne, you're sexy as hell. Thank you. Laura Smith.
Hi, Laura.
Laura! And then we have Nina Mojica or Mojica.
Ooh,
rare.
I like that.
Either way, it sounds exotic. So I'm a huge fan.
Nice. We
love
are
you guys.
Huge fans. She's got a wonderful mythical creature for you.
I do. Your mythical creature is a banshee. Hear me out. Beautiful female mythical creatures from Irish lore, often seen as these like beautiful women in white dresses with this long flowy red hair. They do shriek and scream really loud. Which Devin's been waiting to do that. And they're often associated with like a bad omen, but also a warning to save someone you love that is in danger of dying. So you guys are just like some Irish whistleblowing hotties. And I love that for you.
Can I just say, every time we do a mythical creature, I can always think of the episode in Charmed.
Yes. Yep.
Piper turned into a banshee.
You're right. She did.
She did.
I haven't watched Charmed in years. We used to love that show a million years ago.
We did.
Anybody else?
Banshee. Piper was grieving.
Speaking of shows, do you watch Bridgerton?
No.
Fuck! I want to talk to somebody about Bridgerton. Somebody message me about Bridgerton.
I think you'll probably just get about 100 now. So.
Oh my God, I wish you would. Okay, the carriage scene.
Kate, reel it in.
I can't. I can't do it.
Reel it in.
You would love Bridgerton. It's All a right. sin that you don't watch it.
Okay.
Okay. Anyway.
Maya.
Let's do this whole situation.
So we left off.
Where we left off.
Was the hurricane.
Yes. So, first of all, trigger warnings. We're again discussing a debilitating childhood illness, mental illness, and some themes of suicide sort of throughout the entire thing. We get more into the suicide stuff in part three, so we won't really be touching much on that at all this part. So you're safe for now, but I will, in part three, give you a good warning before we talk heavily into that.
And I think we're going to see a lot of, in this part, like you said, the clinical stuff, the hospital side.
This is all
really get
hospitalization.
Into the part that the documentary did not cover.
Exactly.
Wrap it up in part three and have a good discussion.
Yeah, a good discussion. So, where we left off, Maya, who's a 9-year-old from Florida, had come down with this debilitating, painful illness that nobody seemed to be able to figure out. Excuse me. And due to the tenacity of her parents, mainly her mother, Beata, who was an RN, they did finally get her established with a specialist by the name of Dr. Anthony Kirkpatrick, who diagnosed her with complex regional pain syndrome. We review that in detail in part one, as well as the treatment for that, which is, you know, the one of the more successful treatments is ketamine. Please listen to part one if you missed it, because there's a lot of info there. So with limited options and faced with the possibility of watching their daughter waste away due to this illness, they make the difficult decision to fly her to Mexico for this experimental treatment, where they induce a ketamine coma for 5 days. She comes out of that feeling better. She does well for several months.
Gaining strength back.
Gaining strength, gaining functionality. Until a little less than a year later, though, in October 2016, where Maya suddenly relapses. And her parents rush her to the ER at Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital in the middle of the night during a hurricane. And this is where the hospitalization in question begins. So they get to the ER. Jack recounts that the first nurse that they encountered in the triage department did the whole triage situation, was not familiar with CRPS at all, which most people are probably not. So right. that's really
Again,
not unusual.
Very rare.
Very rare disorder. And it's also very, I mean, even the people that do know about it, there's limited research on it. So, you know, how much can we know about
it? And as we learned in part one, the treatment for it is not even done in the U.S.
Exactly.
Which I have thoughts for when we get there.
Exactly. So, and when the Kowalskis arrived, Paul, they're probably the most knowledgeable people in the building about this disease.
That's true.
I mean, honestly.
And their daughter. And their child.
And their child.
And that's fact-based for a parent.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. And I think we've all sort of encountered, you know, it in our medical endeavors, like somebody who has something very rare or very complex that we're not familiar with, and that patient knows the ins and outs mm-hmm. or their parent knows the ins and outs better than you do.
Absolutely.
And you kind of just have to put your heads together and work it out mm-hmm. together. Mm-hmm. So that's just, you know, it's a thing that happens, I think, to all of us at some point in time. We can't all know everything. It's impossible.
I would love to.
I would love to. Some of us think we might all know everything. I don't claim to know everything. So where the breakdown starts to happen is when the Kowalskis sort of get into the ER and the parents start insisting to start Maya on high dose ketamine, IV ketamine. And we all know how Beata is. She is headstrong. She is outspoken. According to staff at the ER that night and the staff that cared for her along the way, she came off very aggressive and demanding. So essentially, she's in an ER in the middle of the night saying, you need to give my daughter XYZ milligrams of ketamine IV, and you need to infuse this, and you need to infuse that, and she will finally feel better. My daughter is suffering. You need to do this. And again, you know, these providers being unfamiliar with the illness and are being confronted and essentially demanded to prescribe these really, really, really massive doses of ketamine. We talked in part one again about ketamine and its controversy. It's not without its risks and its dangers. And providers were understandably extremely concerned about prescribing these astronomical doses to a 10-year-old kid, because they would be undertaking a massive amount of liability.
For sure.
And of course, they don't want any harm to befall this child on their watch.
And so that's what I was going to say. You know, so the family had to go to Mexico. And, you know, I mean, we know that Mexico has, you know, some things, they do things a little different here and whatever. But, and does Mexico have an FDA? I would assume they have some kind of
similar body.
I would assume. Yeah. So there's a reason why it was only in Mexico right now. You know what I mean? Are they more advanced? I don't know.
Exactly.
But there's a reason why our FDA, going through the process, you know what I mean, that you couldn't do it here.
100%.
And so it's definitely alarming for them to be like, whoa, you want us to put all of this into a 9-year-old?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's definitely...
I totally understand that. There's actually a lot of experimental procedures that are done routinely in other countries that are not available in the U.S. Some of them, I wish were available in the U.S. because some of these treatments have been proven to work, and for whatever reason, they're just not available here. And that can get frustrating. So, I understand the other side of that, too, you know? So, I mean, these doctors are looking at this kid, and they're like, is it even possible that to give this much ketamine to a child? I mean, that's the amount that they that these people were demanding. Like, that's the in milligrams to give to their kid. And mom is demanding these high doses. And, you know, that creates a red flag situation, because this exact scenario is a very classic sign of medical child abuse or parental diversion from their kids.
Right.
Like, is it possible that this kid is tolerating this much ketamine, or is mom demanding that dose because she wants to divert for herself, or dad is doing that? Like, who knows? The problem is that happens. And these ER providers have probably seen it. And people do this. I mean, they know what people are capable of. They see this shit all the time. So they see what humans are capable of, and they don't know these people from Adam. So rightly, that raises a red flag.
Going on.
Exactly.
Thankfully, they're not just like, okay, ma'am, we're going to do that. You know what I mean? Because that's, that's valid too.
Because I feel like you wouldn't be a very good provider if you were just like, okay, I'm not going to look into this at all. I'm just going to trust you 100%. I totally get that. I totally get that. But then on the other side, you know, they're starting to grow frustrated because, again, no one's listening to them. And again, no one's believing them. And the other problem is Maya, when you look at her, she doesn't look like she's in a lot of pain. And that becomes an issue through this entire hospitalization.
Right.
And these providers are left wondering, is this kid truly at a 10 out of 10 pain when she's literally kind of just chilling in the bed? I mean, most kids are like writhing and wincing and crying when they're in that level of pain. Is Maya really having that pain and she's just learned to cope over the years because she's been in pain for so long? Or, and like, she's just very stoic? Or is you know, she not really having that pain?
It's interesting. I just ran into, there's a, you know, a family that's in an activity with my kids, and the daughter just recently broke her arm. So when I ran into the father, you know, and they were talking about it, and he said, you know, it's interesting because we even questioned, we waited because we weren't sure if it was broken, if her wrist was broken, because the daughter was fine.
Right.
And she's just like, oh, it hurts a little bit. But, and so when they did get her checked out, they said, you need to take her in for anything that's questionable because this girl has a very high pain tolerance.
Wow.
Yeah.
And
this is
happens.
In this town. You know what I mean? Like,
and exactly. Uh-huh. And kids in general are resilient when it comes to pain. I mean, we hear like when people, you know, kids stub their toe, oh, mom. And it seems like, okay, walk it off, kid. You're fine. But when kids are really sick,
Yeah.
They are very stoic and they are
through.
Incredibly resilient. So it's really tough to say if what they were seeing like really jived with Maya's chronic illness, because that's the thing about chronic illnesses too, is that sometimes you can't see them on the outside and there's no actual data. You know, there's no labs, there's no test for some things, and it's just a clinical diagnosis. And, you know, it just gets very gray in this area. And it's really tough, you know, to sort of fault either side here, because, you know, I totally understand where the providers were coming from and I understand the parents' frustration at the end of the day. So Dr. Lalay Bahar Posey was a pediatric emergency physician who was involved in Maya's care that night. In a later deposition, she recalled, Maya's mother's concern was administering ketamine over and over, more and more and more. And hours go by and no one is really administering the ketamine in the dose that Maya needs in order to recover from this. Mm. And again, there's not a ton of data on this. The research is now just still emerging. So ketamine is this drug, again, that's not without its risk. And these providers and nurses are immediately on high alert about this case because the doses and frequencies that the Kowalskis are requesting are higher than that of any of these providers have even ever encountered.
Did they know about the doctor in Mexico at this point?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yep.
The parents did, but did the hospital?
Yeah. They were telling them this entire time, she sees a specialist. Yeah. You can call this specialist. She's been in a ketamine coma. She tolerated that fine. She takes this much ketamine orally at home. This is what she needs. And these doctors are like, but this is totally outside of the realm of what we normally prescribe. And am I comfortable putting myself and this kid's life on the line by prescribing a dose that high?
For sure.
So other physicians would go on to describe this initial encounter in their depositions as well. And one other pediatrician involved in Maya's care stated, quote, she was belligerent. She was demanding. She showed up and stated to us, this is what you're going to do. Is this a mom that is just like, I know what my kid needs? Mm-hmm. Or was something else going on?
Yeah. Like, I also was wondering, too, you know, we've done a lot of research over the last 40 plus years.
Yes.
On the autism spectrum.
Yes.
And social cues. Yes. Of like someone with Asperger's.
100%.
And they come off as, I'm not, this is not me saying Maya's mom had this.
We are armchair diagnosing.
We are, this is just a, I had this thought, you know, you got a cultural difference.
I was going to say language barrier.
You got a cultural difference there.
100%.
She's from Poland. So there's that. So language barrier, the ways of speaking, the way you present yourself. But then also I was just thinking, because I've come into some adults in my life where when we were kids, wasn't underdiagnosed.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And there's some of these social awkwardness that come off as arrogance.
100%.
Come off as, you know, abrasive.
Yes.
And so I just had that thought too.
100%. You
know, and then again, where she grew up in Poland, is that relevant? I don't know.
Well, I think it is.
This is just all my arm of chair Devin thoughts.
I think it is, because I also did read some articles about Beata's upbringing and their environment in Poland. And her siblings' childhood was not great in Poland around that time, which is understandable. And, you know, she may just be survival mode activated, you know, because that's her trauma response.
Right.
Yes. So, you know, it's one of those things that's tough, so
because
tough.
You can see why red flags are like, you will do this now.
Yes, 100%.
And you can't fault the hospital for being on defense on the side of the patient.
100%.
On the side of her
daughter. 100%.
You can't blame them for that.
100%.
But it does make you just question.
Yes.
It makes it a little more.
Makes it very a gray situation.
Everyone's favorite color lately is gray.
I know. So. It's clear at this time that, you know, Maya's not receiving the medications that her parents want her to, and the providers continued to have concerns about this whole family dynamic. The family is just feeling like they're not being taken seriously enough in this scenario. Beata continues to escalate, get angrier, demand things. Her family recalls that Beata started getting really upset and starting to really assert and like really fight for what she needed. And she was saying things like, that's the treatment she needs, or she's just going to continue to be in pain. I don't want her to suffer. Please just give her, this is what you need. So the providers continue to try to explain to the family, there are risks. Cardiac arrhythmias. Your daughter could go into a respiratory arrest if we administer this much ketamine. Your daughter could literally die if we give her too much ketamine. All very valid concerns. And the Kowalskis are like, listen, dude, we understand this disease process, the treatment for it. We understand that probably better than you do. And these are the doses she needs. She tolerates high doses regularly every day. And this is the only thing that works for her. It is a well-documented treatment plan by her physician. Here's their contact information. Here's the treatment plan. Here's the prescriptions. She's been literally in a ketamine coma. And please do what needs to be done for her. So from the ER, it's clear that they're not going to get this under control, like in the middle of the night, mm-hmm. with that dynamic in the ER. So they admit her to the PICU for ongoing management. They start giving her some IV ketamine infusions, but at more of a reasonable dose. So at least according to her family and Dr. Kirkpatrick, not enough. So as we get into her hospitalization, Dr. Kirkpatrick is contacted and he does call the hospital and discuss with the providers her care and the ketamine she's required in the past.
So they're starting to do their due diligence.
Yeah, they are.
Like, let's at least look into this.
Exactly.
We're not giving it to her quite yet, but we're looking into it.
Exactly. It should be noted that Maya was underweight when she was admitted. And I note this because it's another factor that led to the allegations of medical child abuse. That is another big red flag. This can be a common finding when kids are admitted.
How much?
So I don't actually know exactly how much, but she actually, during her initial hospitalization, really, it was really a struggle to get her to eat. And she was on TPN for a period of time in the hospital. So she required that to maintain her nutritional status.
Nice job keeping that out, documentary.
I'm telling you, you will not believe the things that they just lightly glazed over just to create this narrative.
So I get why our fans were like, guys.
100%.
But it's also like, you know us. We're going to do our due diligence.
We're going to get there. It's all good.
We're moving on.
Speaking of which, one of our listeners pointed me towards a podcast that was very helpful. And so in the research, I'm using the court documents. I'm using the affidavits from the lawsuits. I'm using the documentary. I also listened to this podcast called Nobody Should Believe Me. And they did an entire like season on this whole case, a very deep dive. They go through every single bit of evidence, essentially, that was through everything that has been publicized is reviewed with expert commentary, with police investigators, physicians, and I'm going to include as much as I can here. I wish we could do a whole season on this because there is enough to do an entire season on this, but we can't. So if you want more details and more things that are going to make you really scratch your head, please listen to season 3 of Nobody Should Believe Me. It's incredible. They don't need the shout out from me because they're thriving on their own, but wonderful. Please go listen if you want more info on this. Yeah. It is incredible. So, with that, a pediatrician by the name of Dr. Farhan Malek, who is a pediatric intensivist that was involved in Maya's care during her stay at Johns Hopkins, was deposed also during the investigation. He had reported that, quote, nothing we were doing was working, such that we began questioning the diagnosis of complex regional pain syndrome altogether. Things started becoming more belligerent, and her mom started talking about taking Maya out of the hospital. And that's where we as a team started feeling unsafe about Maya's living situation. So according to Maya's family, it wasn't working because they weren't giving her enough ketamine. Mm-hmm. But the doses that they were giving her, I mean, they were giving her, you know, a lot of ketamine. I mean, for me and you, like to compare, like to me and you, it would have, you know, probably put us on the floor, the amount of ketamine that she was getting. So they were like pushing the boundaries of what they were comfortable with giving her and giving her a lot of other supportive medicines. Like they were giving her things like clonidine and Ultram and other things that were going to be managing her symptoms, and nothing was working. So again, according to Maya's family, it wasn't working because they weren't giving her enough. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say, you know, was this just CRPS that wasn't responding because it was pretty advanced and she really did need those doses? Not sure. And then Beata begins requesting an intrathecal pain pump to be placed in Maya's spine. So these are often reserved for people on hospice for pain control.
Yes.
or people with advanced CP, mm-hmm. they are used rarely in cases of pain for pain control in CRPS, usually in adults. The problem is that Maya had not really tried and failed all other treatment modalities yet. This really just is more of a last ditch effort. And it was sort of to the team. It was sort of like asking someone.
Why was she insisting on it?
Because
she doesn't know.
Well, that's the thing. And to the team, it was sort of like, oh, I sprained my ankle. Please amputate my foot. You know what I mean? Like a way too invasive and advanced treatment for.
Got it.
And then again, they're looking at Maya, who is barely making a sound, not wincing. She's like acting like a normal kid who just can't walk and get out of bed. And she's just not walking. I mean, she's saying she's in a 7, 8, 9, 10 out of pain, but looking at her, they're not convinced. Again, kids are very resilient and can hide their pain very well. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say. You know, I understand both sides and I don't know what to think. It's so frustrating.
There's so much gray.
Yes.
I'm looking at gray blankets.
Gray blankets, gray. We're gray in here. This is the gray basement, gray cement
so
walls,
gray.
The gray carpet.
This is a wide gray area.
We have a wide berth of gray. So, and at one point during her hospitalization, an ultrasound had been ordered to work up her ongoing abdominal pain. And then the tech comes in to do the ultrasound, and Beata told them, quote, the only way you're going to be able to perform that is if you give her an extremely high dose of ketamine.
For an ultrasound?
Yeah.
It's external.
Uh-huh. So again, this is another thing that the providers were like, this is odd. I mean, even people having abdominal pain can usually tough it out for an ultrasound. Like, we don't need to. I mean, look at
my
her. She looks okay.
My appendix was burst, and I tolerated an ultrasound.
That's the thing.
No,
people can be bleeding
shit
internally, and they're putting probes on people. And it's like, I understand that this disease process and this pain is different than internal organ pain. It's nerve pain. You know, it is probably a lot more painful than that. But I mean, it's a quick study. You don't like. She's asking them to medicate her for every single little. I mean, this is a fairly minor procedure, right?
Interesting.
So that's why I'm kind of mentioning these little details that were just not mentioned.
That make you go,
that's weird.
Huh.
That doesn't make sense. And I'm trying to sort of, I mean, they had a lot of reasons to suspect abuse. They really did. There were a lot of red flags here. And was this just a very unusual scenario with a very chronically ill kid who did need these high doses and would have been fine on these high doses? You know, it's like kind of, you know, it's kills me.
I still got some stuff when we get there, though.
Yeah.
That,
oh, yeah.
That the documentary did make me go.
Oh, I know.
Why?
We'll get there.
You know, with some of the medical people.
100%. And we're going to get into that, too. Some of the things that were unethical.
Healthy debate.
Healthy debate.
A good, healthy debate.
I love a healthy debate.
We are like Democrats and Republicans over here.
Healthy.
Healthy debates.
Yeah. No, just like trolls. No trolls here. Nope. Healthy communication.
Here we go.
So with that questioning of her diagnosis, as well as the continued insistence from her family that the team is under-medicating her, came more concern that this was actually a case of medical child abuse, ketamine drug diversion, or possibly Munchausen syndrome by proxy.
Right.
And this becomes a very real concern. We've discussed Munchausen by proxy before, mm-hmm. and actually more recently, it's become known by a new name, which is factitious disorder imposed on another.
Yes.
So definitions remain exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Essentially, it's a mental illness in which an individual acts as if a child or someone else under their care is ill, often creating symptoms or signs or illnesses themselves, lying about these illnesses, making up false medical conditions. This can lead to over-hospitalizations, over-medications, unnecessary procedures or surgeries, injury, illness, death. People have died from this. Mm-hmm. It's very, very sad. I'm going to read a few of the caregiver behaviors associated with or indicative of factitious disorder imposed on another or medical child abuse, just so that we get some context and some, you know.
Yep.
So. The child has had many healthcare providers, tests, or procedures. The abused has strange symptoms that don't necessarily fit or are uncommon with any disease. The child or caregiver has an unusually detailed knowledge of medical terminology, procedures, or medications. The caregiver refutes or is angered by any disagreement from medical teams. So we can clearly see...
But, again,
mm-hmm.
So let's start back at number one.
Yeah.
So what was number one again?
Number one was the child has had many healthcare providers, tests, or procedures.
Correct. Which would happen in a rare disorder.
100%.
So, yep.
Again.
So this is again. So then number two was what?
Number two was the abused has strange symptoms that don't fit or are uncommon within any disease.
Any or rare. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Number three.
And this is the argument by the Kowalski family named in this lawsuit. A child or caregiver has an unusually detailed knowledge of medical terminology.
The mother's a nurse. She's a registered nurse.
Here's the thing.
Uh-oh.
Here's the thing.
Oh, you got something?
Munchausen or factitious disorder imposed on another is way more common among nurses or other medical professionals. They are commonly abusers.
Okay.
They are because...
So that's fair.
Yes.
But again,
yep.
As a mom who's a nurse
mm-hmm.
that doesn't have a mental illness, at least yet, but, you know...
We'll get there. Keep doing this podcast. We'll get there.
But, you know what I mean? Like...
Yep.
If you've been with your child to each of these appointments, it still could be possible.
Oh, I 100% agree.
But agreed.
Just playing devil's advocate.
So this is why you can see why the hospital made these.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
When you're reaching all the points of what qualifies under a risk for Munchausen's,
exactly.
They're meeting it.
And
however,
exactly.
A defense person, a defense attorney or whatever, you know, could be
it
like,
it could swing either way.
Reasonable doubt.
There's an argument for both sides. And so... Doctors, nurses, social workers, and anyone else working in this setting are mandated reporters.
Yes.
What this means is that the medical staff is required by law to report any reasonable suspicion of abuse. Reasonable suspicion.
With, also at the end of that, without fear of retribution.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
And this is the part that's getting a kicker where the end result of this lawsuit
is not on them.
Correct, but
yes.
Like this is the part that's getting the medical community up in arms.
Exactly.
About mandatory reporting is
exactly.
Because we're supposed to be able to do this
yes.
Without fear of retribution.
Exactly. Healthcare providers are not required to obtain proof and do a whole investigation. They are required to report any reasonable suspicion of abuse.
I agree as to why
yes.
They reported this.
100%. 100%.
I completely agree with this.
This is exactly what happened here. And whether or not there was actual abuse, they did what they thought was the right thing to do at the time.
The nurses and the providers and the doctors that were dealing right then.
Yes.
I think my question gets into some of the administration.
Yeah, I agree.
Think some of the ancillary, but
yes.
The direct care
yes.
That made this report.
Yes.
Completely agree.
100%.
Completely agree.
So at this point, the family is told, you cannot leave with Maya. We've made this report. If you try to leave with Maya, you will be stopped. They would not be allowed to leave with their daughter due to this suspicion. And of course, the medical team are mandated reporters. And so they report this situation to DCF, the Department of Children and Families.
This stops the ability also for Bayada to be able to be like, okay, we're leaving against medical advice.
Well, exactly.
Because
now
that right as a parent, but
there is a safety concern.
Correct.
Right. For her being able to go home.
So they did the right thing.
I think so. I 100%. Think so. While at least... This did blow up for Maya into something I think that was completely unnecessary for her to go through. At the end of the day, she still went through this. She is in the middle of this.
Right. Whether she's the center of it.
She is at the center of it. She suffered. She has been through way more than most adults.
Mm-hmm.
There is no way she needed to go through what she went through at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And I think she does deserve some retribution for that.
Right.
Is the hospital responsible? I don't know, but we'll get into it more in part three. But I do feel really bad for Maya
mm-hmm.
about all of this because at the end of the day, she was separated from her family and isolated.
If it was not abuse, she went through that and didn't need to.
Exactly.
If it was abuse, she went through
she
all
was
of
abused.
That with her mother.
Exactly.
And it continued and then resulted in her mother's death.
That's why I'm like, my God, this is devastating mm-hmm. for Maya. Mm-hmm. It's devastating. So the medical team then decides to consult a specialist on that particular matter. So one day, Jack is visiting his daughter, and he's sitting with her. In walks a woman by the name of Dr. Sally Smith. So she is a pediatrician who specializes in child abuse. Mm-hmm. She is a child abuse pediatrician, which I actually didn't know that these existed, but it's like a thing. They are pediatricians who often work with state-funded entities mm-hmm. to do assessments and make determinations on and make diagnoses of things like Munchausen by proxy or, mm-hmm. you know, other cases of medical child abuse. So she was called to perform an assessment and to see if she thought this was a true case of an acute medical event or was this potentially medical child abuse. So this is how Jack and Maya recall that that encounter happened. And this is how the documentary sort of outlines their perspective of what happened. They both reported that this woman walks in the room, did not introduce herself, and acted as if she was part of the regular medical team. So she was in the room for about 10 minutes, evaluating and interviewing Maya and her father. Jack recalls that she asked questions like, why would you allow someone to give such high doses of ketamine to your daughter? Why would you allow this? And details about her treatments, things like that. And then after she left, without saying much of anything.
And why was it with Jack and not Beata?
So Beata, at this point, because there's a question of her.
So they wanted to talk separately.
They asked her to stay out of the hospital at this point, and that actually becomes a whole.
Because they're thinking she's the abuser.
And this
Maya's still a minor.
Exactly.
Father. Yeah.
And then that becomes official when they put the shelter order in place, which we'll get into next. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that that is close to what their experience was. And they said that if they knew that she was a child abuse provider, that they never would have spoken to her. They didn't want anything to do with her. Neither of them felt like Maya was being abused.
That's also not going to help your case, though.
Well, that's the thing. But their perception isn't entirely what Sally Smith's workflow is. So as a child abuse pediatrician, the bulk of her role is actually reviewing past medical records. History and, you know, really getting a sense of how many providers has this kid seen. She also has to sort of conduct a little bit of an investigation on her own by contacting other medical providers that have seen her. So in reality, behind the scenes, this was actually a very extensive review on her part. Mm-hmm. And after that encounter, Sally Smith submitted a 45-page report on this case. You know, this was very extensive.
But you can't get all of it from 10 minutes.
No, I mean, that's not, and I understand that that's their, you know, it's a piece that needs to be done. She needs to meet the family and talk with them briefly, but that's really not the bulk of her role in this. So this is something that, so what was found in this little investigation and this report was that concerns of medical child abuse were not only brought up during this hospitalization. Other providers who saw her during that prior year when she was getting diagnosed had documented that they suspected medical child abuse or Munchausen by proxy.
If they suspected it, why wasn't it reported?
We'll get into in part three how criminally underreported medical child abuse is. Because it still is very, like, way underreported.
And so I don't know if you touch upon this part, but this hospital, the number of reports that they do.
Mm-hmm. And it's not the hospital, it's actually the county that Sally Smith works for. Right. And we get into that too in part three.
Okay, so then I'll hold for that. Because that is alarming too. So
it is.
It makes you like.
But there's other factors in that that they do, that they, again, they sway this narrative.
Yes.
That's the county that contains Tampa, Florida, and their substance abuse rates.
I was going to say, what
are
other
astronomically high
is left out.
Exactly.
The socioeconomic factors.
Exactly. So there's, I mean, it all sounds great on paper until you like really look at things.
Or
it's so hard.
It's great on a documentary.
On a documentary, it really does help to sway that narrative. But again, I mean, it just goes to show you how easy it is to really flip a narrative and to make things seem a different way. And then headlines.
Because when you and I were first talking to it, you were just like, fuck this guy.
Oh, my
God. You know what
I
mean?
I know.
And then now it's like, well, here's her 45-page report.
I know.
You know? Yeah.
And she found that this was not the first time this had been mentioned.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that makes it even maybe a little bit more likely that there was. Mm-hmm. There was something to be concerned about here. You know what I mean? So this actually adds more validity to the possibility that there was some abuse going on here. So, you know, it's another one of those crazy things. And then another factor in this whole issue as to why providers that were caring for Maya as an inpatient were questioning the diagnosis of CRPS was that, again, she looked great. She didn't appear to be in any pain. But again,
was she experiencing any of the other symptoms like the bow-legged feet?
She did have dystonic lower limbs. But again, we're going to get into that. We'll get into it a little bit more about how her symptoms seemed to the medical team to be inconsistent.
Okay.
And how she would report that something hurts or that she can't do something, and then they would see her do that thing. To play devil's advocate, CRPS, Maya argues that there are some days that are worse than others. There are some days that I can, moments that I can do things that, you know, maybe I can wiggle my toes at one moment and then another moment that I can't. That's the nature of the disease. So it's, again, it's wild. This gets wild. It really does get crazy. So at that point, multiple members of her care team had submitted documentation that they were questioning the diagnosis of CRPS altogether because she was so stoic, because she wasn't responding to anything that they were doing for her, albeit at much lower doses of ketamine than she was used to, and they were getting suspicious. So that Maya was a victim of medical child abuse and that her mother might have factitious disorder imposed on another. So through all of this, of note, Maya and her dad maintained that the disease, her symptoms, her pain were all incredibly real, incredibly valid. And having lived in that house, they claim that Beata never once requested anything beyond on behalf of her daughter that was unreasonable. Never once requested anything that, you know, was supposed to go to Maya and then went to Beata. And they never once felt that they urged Maya to go through something that was unnecessary. Having lived in that house with Beata, they all vehemently deny any of those allegations. Mm. They staunchly believe no abuse took place. Although, I keep saying although and I go back and forth. We listen to who we love and we trust who we love. And Jack Blinders. And Kyle and Beata. Love is blind. They looked up to Beata. She was the matriarch of this family and an RN with a lot of knowledge. And she was researching and she was getting all this information. And they were kind of listening to Beata's direction.
Me, I'm sure as your husband does. Exactly. When it comes to our kids.
The medical stuff. Yes.
When to be concerned, not to be concerned.
So they're all trusting her to do the right thing. And they all to this day believe that she always did the right thing, which she might have been doing the right thing the entire time. And Maya is only 9 years old. So, of course, she thinks her mom is doing the right thing and asking for the right stuff. Or 10 years old at this point, excuse me. So it's impossible to say for sure. There are people that are abused their whole lives and would never admit to it, never realize it, because they just feel that, you know, they love me. How could they be abusing me if they love me? And I know Beata loved her kids. Mm-hmm. She loved the crap out of Maya. That is very evident. And I will never argue that. Also, Beata is not on trial here. So,
no, she's not.
I mean,
again, may she rest in peace.
May she rest in peace. So with that, first and second formal reports were filed with the state of Florida, citing parental neglect and possibly overtreatment. The report stated that the Kowalskis, that Beata Kowalski is believed to, quote, have mental issues, end quote, and that, quote, Maya is not in any pain, but mom insists Maya is in pain, end quote. So with that, Beata was asked to not come back to the hospital formally. So her dad is going to the hospital and visiting her in this stage. But essentially, since her visit to the ER in the first couple days in the ICU, Beata has not been allowed to see her kid.
Like, happy medium of supervised visits.
The thing is, we're also not taking into the account that Beata was disruptive. She was a disruptive visitor.
Fair.
Right? So,
as I've dealt with a few in my own setting, you're right.
You ask that person to leave when they become disruptive. Yeah. You can't act like that in a medical setting in front of other patients, other families.
You're right.
And I understand her frustration. Mm-hmm. I do. You're right. But
you can't make threats.
You can't be threatening.
You can't be aggressive.
Exactly.
And as hard as it is, then you have to be like, well, she is a minor. She has to have the guard. But then that's why they take custody.
Exactly.
So then they have the custody. No matter how hard you believe that is,
yep,
and you can't fathom, it is the right thing.
Yes. It's wild, right? Wow. Of note, during Dr. Smith's interview with Drs. Hanna and Kirkpatrick, the specialist the specialists that she saw for CRPS, they advised Dr. Smith, Munchausen by proxy or factitious disorder imposed on another is a common misdiagnosis in CRPS cases in children. It happens a lot, in particular with CRPS, because it's one of those diseases you can't test for and you can't see on the outside. Okay, so
then that's interesting, because this disease is so damn rare.
Yes, exactly.
And so then when you have the rarity numbers of what it is, and then Munchausen's is so much higher in this very rare disease.
Yes.
What is it, like 3 out of 5? You know what I mean?
No,
like,
it's a common misdiagnosis. Right. So because people are going to the doctor constantly, mm-hmm. because people are seeing a bunch of specialists and not getting a diagnosis, wow. and because they cautioned Dr. Smith, don't falsely accuse family members of criminal conduct. It could result in needless and permanent harm to the child and her family. Mm-hmm. But of course, none of that was included in the final report to DCFS.
Okay.
Sally Smith did not include that part of the interview in her report.
Why do you think?
I don't know if she didn't feel it was relevant or she didn't agree. She mm-hmm. certainly was not obligated to include that mm-hmm. one sentence, but I feel like it was kind of a big piece that was left out. Mm-hmm. I don't know that that was entirely ethical mm-hmm. because I feel like that's relevant.
For sure.
So after these reports, the state issues a formal shelter order, which essentially means that Maya was to be kept in the hospital until these legal matters are resolved. Mm-hmm. Because what the hospital didn't want to do was to send Maya home into the care of her parents when they might be abusing her in an unsafe situation. Mm-hmm. So who knows? They could have just taken off with Maya and
gone to Mexico.
Gone to Mexico.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. So this goes on. 4 months. Mm-hmm. And
this is why it's called the medical kidnapping.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And under this shelter order, her father is now not able to come and visit her either. So at this stage, her parents as a unit are asked to not come back to the hospital legally. And she is staying at this hospital alone 4 months.
Could you imagine?
No.
Your daughter's almost 9.
I can't imagine for my daughter. Like, I would be, if I were Beata, I would be clawing my hair out. Mm-hmm. I would be doing anything that I possibly could to try to legally get this overturned. Mm-hmm. I would do whatever they wanted me to do to make it so that I could see my kid and be with my kid who's in the hospital.
For sure.
Like, I'm very angry for her parents that this happened to them. Mm-hmm. But I understand why it happened. Mm-hmm. So I'm in a weird place right now with
She's
my feelings.
She's in a weird place.
I'm in a weird place with my feelings.
We got the mom and the professional.
It's like wild. So this goes on for months. Maya is isolated from her parents. In the hospital, even being away from her parents, she's still complaining of pain and still claiming to not be able to use her legs. Other providers, as well as Dr. Smith, even start insinuating that they were considering the possibility that this was not factitious disorder imposed on another, but it might just be factitious disorder on Maya's part. Is Maya faking? Is Maya really in pain?
Because Maya the Munchausen.
Now that she's separated from her parents and she's still claiming she's in pain, but she doesn't look like she's in pain, which again, how much that does that mean anything? I don't know. I don't think so. And they even went as far as to insinuate that some of the lesions and skin injuries were self-inflicted.
Really?
Yes. Hmm. Yes.
Because they had a camera on her. Right?
Yes.
They had a camera on her
yep.
in the hospital.
Intermittently they did.
Right.
And we go into that as well.
Okay.
So we get into December at this point, and the shelter order is updated and changed to allow Maya to see her father at that point, because mm-hmm. they've sort of done enough research at that point to kind of determine, okay, it doesn't look like her father really is the problem here. He's
just,
not been disruptive.
Beata.
He's not been demanding. It's really just been Beata. So Beata still has to stay out, but her father is now, as of December, allowed to come and mm-hmm. visit. And Beata is only allowed one phone call or video call with Beata per day. As a mom, that does really rip my heart out. It really does. Mm-hmm. But if she was abusing her, you know, whether or not Beata herself realized it. Exactly. Yeah. If she, again, I don't discount that Beata loved her kids. I really don't. I think that she did. And whether or not she realized she was abused, I don't know. I don't know.
I'm not doing well with my kid having to go to kindergarten in a few months. And the fact that I'm not going to get the daycare app all day long telling me what he's doing.
Yeah, you get used to that.
Forget not talking I know. To them for a whole day. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yep. Now.
But I don't abuse my children.
Well, exactly. Now, Kathy Beattie is a social worker who at that time worked at Hopkins All Children's Hospital and was heavily involved in Maya's care. And she was documented as spending tons of time in Maya's room. And the documentary does outline this a little bit because Kathy is one of the individuals that is actually named in the big lawsuit later on. And we'll get into that. So she was sitting with her a lot, spending a lot of time in the room. Maya reported that Elaine would say things to her like, your parents might be abusing her, like your parents might be abusing you, and your parents aren't acting in your best interest, and we're going to get this figured out. And I mean, that alone, without having access to your parents, must have been absolutely traumatizing. Mm-hmm. Having mm-hmm. this other adult.
Because you believe, you know, you believe everything. You're supposed to trust other adults.
Well, that's the thing.
You love and trust your parents, but then they're saying this about your parents.
It's giving brainwash. Yeah. You know, let the adults figure out the adult stuff. Leave this kid out of it. If you really were saying that shit to her, like, fuck yeah. you.
You crossed a line.
You way crossed a line.
It's similar, you know, like how people feel like just in a divorce, you can't talk about the other parent.
Well, that's the thing. You can't, because you can't do that.
You start to change the kid's mind, you know what I mean, as far as like what they think about the other one.
She has been through enough.
This is a professional.
Whether or not she was abused, she has been through enough.
Yeah.
Like,
this is a professional. You
need leave to her out of that shit. You do not need to be talking like that about the kid's parents in front of the kid. I'm sorry. And again, Kathy is later named in that lawsuit in question, which we get into in part three. Initially, the Kowalskis alleged sexual abuse from Kathy because of an incident that in which photos were taken of Maya that were needed for the investigation. And Maya stated that she came into her room in the hospital, stripped her down, took photos of her in her underwear. This makes me feel really gross.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently this was reviewed by risk management at the hospital, and the decision was made to have the photos taken at the hospital by Kathy, who was the more trusted staff member at that time, to Maya, instead of making her go to the DCF office, because that was the other option, to get them taken. They felt like that would be more distressing and more for her.
I feel like that was gone about the wrong way.
I think so, too. And you at least need to call the parents and give them a heads up, because Jack claims he was never informed or gave consent for that.
That should be, like, this is going to happen. You can't
yes.
consent.
Yes, notify. At least notify. Custody.
But, like, also, like, we're letting you come in.
Yeah.
Because it's a supervised thing.
Exactly.
Jack, if you be out of camp, but if Jack, you know, do you want to be in here, hold your daughter's hand as yes. a witness to, like, yes. whatever. There should have been a second person in the room.
100%.
There should have been a second person in the room, whether it was a parent or another professional.
Yes.
There should have been to rule out that potential abuse.
100%. Allegation. So I feel like this was
there should have been a second there. Person.
This was not handled the right
no,
way
no,
at
it
all.
Wasn't. No.
And I don't know that we even have the whole picture on that, honestly, yeah. on what happened yeah. and stuff. But Kathy was also accused in the lawsuit of some over affectionate behavior towards Maya. Again, she spent a lot of time in the room. She was mm-hmm. often seen sort of like snuggling, cuddling, giving her hugs, giving her kisses, things like that. To be fair, DCF actually recognizes that children need affection and do at mm-hmm. in some situations when parents are separated physically from their kids, encourage reasonable physical contact between staff and children because
well,
they
think
need
about
that.
It too, and a lot of times when the state takes custody, they're in a foster home.
Exactly.
And a foster parent is giving that type of affection
is replacing
to a
that.
Certain standpoint.
Exactly.
And Maya didn't have that.
Exactly.
You know, so yep.
for months. Yeah. For months.
She wasn't put into another home, you know, with a parental type figure.
Exactly.
She was kept in a cold, sterile hospital.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Beata often recorded her conversations with her daughter, as she recorded everything else mm-hmm. that went on. Mm-hmm. There was one recording in the documentary in which she asked Maya about her pain and what she was given for medicine, I believe. And there was a staff member sort of listening in on the call and then had to redirect the conversation mm-hmm. and say, nope, you can't talk about the medical stuff.
I think that's fair.
So the staff did report that during their phone calls, Beata would often ask first about all of the medical stuff. What are they doing? What are they giving you? And I mean, what they were hoping was that they would try to, like, you know, distract Maya. She would try to, like, you know, maybe steer away from that subject mm-hmm. matter and be mm-hmm. like, hey, you know, what did you have for lunch today? And like, what but do you think also, you want to do when you get out of
so
here?
So even though I agree with that, also, as a mom who can't physically see her children.
Oh, it's torture.
If this was legit, she wants to know she's okay.
It's absolute torture not being there and not knowing yes. as a mom.
Yes.
Another thing her care team had concerns about is that Beata referred to the hospital over the phone to Maya as a Nazi camp.
Oh.
Oh. So, like, that was probably inappropriate, Beata. Maybe don't say that to your kid. You know what I mean?
You're Polish.
Yeah.
You should know better. I'm just saying.
This is not funny, but that comment was funny.
She should have known better.
Shouldn't do that.
She's angry.
She's angry. I get that she's angry. I get
Ugh.
It. So as we know, one of Maya's issues along with the abdominal pain was this leg pain, and that she was not walking on her own, and she had that dystonic, mm-hmm. you know, lower limbs and severe pain in her legs. Now, the hospital had started using surveillance cameras for brief periods in Maya's room, and I assume in an effort to be able to, like, document if her parents did try to visit or because she was underage and needed supervision. The legal rationale behind that, I don't really understand.
I was going to say, and was there, like, a legal order that you could do
right,
it?
I'm
like,
not positive.
That gets a little fuzzy.
Yeah. During the investigation and the initial trial, it did come out that there were recordings of Maya moving her legs, and apparently more video of her brother, like, touching her legs and Maya not reacting, which, you know, if anybody else would try to touch her legs, she would go through the roof, you know what I mean? Because with CRPS, even if, like, a feather touches you, right. to them it feels like
a
knife.
Out.
Exactly. So this is part of what the hospital sort of latched onto with the factitious disorder, stating, look, she's making it all up. And when she thinks nobody is looking, she's not keeping up the charade. Mm-hmm. But then Maya goes on to, again, later explain that with the disease process, there are good days and bad days and good moments and bad moments.
I get that. But, like, was there ever good moments when people were looking?
Well, that's the thing.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, exactly.
For months you were there.
Mm-hmm.
You were there for months. You never had a good moment where you could do this in front of a professional.
Exactly. It's tough. And
it's just getting hairy.
I know. And when taking a look at her overall records, the only three providers that were all in agreement that she had CRPS were her primary pediatrician, Dr. Kirkpatrick, and Dr. Hanna. Virtually every other provider she saw with numbers in the hundreds did not believe or were not convinced fully that she
Remind
had CRPS.
Remind me again who Dr. Hanna was.
So he is the other specialist that she was referred to when she could no longer afford to stay.
Okay, that's right, because they had to leave Kirkpatrick.
Exactly,
and go to
exactly.
Okay, you're right.
So Maya later reported having overheard nurses and doctors talking about her in the halls, reporting that she would hear people try to catch her moving her legs, talking about how she's making it up, she's not really in pain. And for a kid who does have a, you know, legitimate chronic illness, or any kid, even if she were well, being isolated in the hospital, like, is that not enough? She doesn't have her parents, like, feeling like no one is believing her, feeling like she's a prisoner.
And it's such a self-conscious age.
Yes. She endorses that this was, like, one of the more traumatic points in this whole mm-hmm. situation. Like, she couldn't even trust the only people that were there to take care of her. And this is how she's being treated by the staff. If that is true, that is extremely unethical, to mm-hmm. say the least. Mm-hmm. There's no excuse for any of that.
She can't be at fault for a lot of
this. No, she is not.
Because if some of this stuff was purposeful or not on Maya's end, it was obviously brainwashed from her mother.
Exactly.
You know what
exactly.
I mean? So you have to be empathetic and sympathetic with
yes.
her.
Yes. So Maya has been in the hospital now for months. She's able to see her dad and brother, but not her mom, and has very limited contact with her mom. And as outlined in the Netflix documentary, Jack admits that things at home were not awesome.
Well, I can't imagine that that wouldn't add any stress to a home life. So.
Nope. Beata keeps trying to reach out and trying to fight for her daughter. And Jack is trying to tell her, Beata, you just need to do what they say right now. Because if you keep stirring the pot, you're going to make it worse. And what we don't want is for the state to take away my dad privileges again. And then Maya will again be completely isolated and alone. Is that what you want? So that was like in the household, a constant point of contention.
You can see why.
I totally get it. Totally get it. So again, whether or not this case is medical child abuse or factitious disorder, this is unbelievably devastating. And it uprooted their entire lives. And it's devastating for Maya because she's the one suffering from all of this. And Jack stated that Beata herself is not in a good place around this time, understandably. So additionally, criminal investigation and criminal, like there's a police investigation, a police inquiry going on now. And based on all those complaints. So now police are coming around, interviewing everyone, showing up to talk to, you know, Maya, even in the hospital, showing up to talk to Jack. They do this whole interview with Jack. So this is becoming a worst case scenario for the family. So if Beata was truly not abusing her daughter, this would have been a nightmarish scenario for this family. I cannot even imagine.
For sure.
If there was some abuse going on, Beata is now probably feeling like the world is closing in on her. And now what do I do? So a hearing that we've all been waiting for finally occurs, in which a judge reviews the shelter order and the visitation with Maya's parents in January of 2017. Maya spends her birthday in the hospital away from her parents.
Now,
Thanksgiving,
mind you, this is January,
Christmas.
I was gonna say, that's a big time of year.
Yes. This is the first time Beata lays eyes physically on her daughter in months during this hearing. Wow. This is the first time they're in the same room together. So the hearing ensues.
Could you imagine the emotions as a mother?
Oh my God.
Oh, I have the shivers.
I do too. I have the chills. And the Kowalski's attorney is like, this is absurd. We shouldn't even be here. There is no abuse happening. Maya needs to come home. This is insane that this has gone on so long. This is borderline abusive on the point of the hospital to Maya, keeping her away from her parents. The judge presiding over the hearing disagreed and decided to uphold the shelter order pending the criminal investigation into the abuse allegations. Then the Kowalski's attorney just asked the judge, listen, we get the ruling, fine. Is there any way that Beata could just walk over for just a second in front of all of us and just give her daughter a hug? Is that okay? And the judge said, no, I don't think that would be a good idea. Not today. Denied her a hug. A hug. And what did he think was going to happen? What did that achieve? Other than to break everyone's heart in the room. What did that achieve? What was the rationale behind that? What harm could have befallen her? I mean, I don't understand that. I really have a hard time understanding that. And
you can understand like we've said already the last hour, like you can understand their position. We support why it was reported and all of those things, but you have to have some kind of compassion.
I mean,
and in this moment, it's the first time they've seen each other for
months.
Yes,
exactly.
You have a judge in the room. You have lawyers. I'm sure there's bailiffs.
Yes.
What was going to happen? You know you're right. What was going to happen?
I think this was very damaging to Beata's mental health, this moment, you know, and this seems, if you look at the whole timeline, to be sort of a tipping point of where things really change for her. So this was a huge loss for the Kowalskis. Everybody is in a fucking terrible place. Maya's still in the hospital. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a shit show. Mm-hmm. And from there, things get about a million times worse. Bye. See you for part three.
A million times worse.
Yes. It's so bad, you guys. Oh my God. It's heartbreaking. This whole thing is just...
Wow.
Somebody get Maya a puppy.
I hope she has
one. I hope she has like 50 puppies.
That poor girl.
Oh my God.
Like I said, regardless of what the truth in the matter was, she's not at fault for any of it. She's,
no.
She's the victim.
I think so.
On either side.
Even if she had factitious disorder herself.
Yes.
That is a mental illness for which she needs treatment.
Yes.
She's not just being an obnoxious kid who's faking everything. I mean, it's not like, what does she have to gain for being stuck in the fucking hospital for 3 months away from her parents? Give the kid a break.
Right, right. And I think we need to reiterate right here what we've said throughout this episode is that you and I both fully agree that when you're presented with that type of information, we fully support the fact that the hospital staff reported this. Yes,
100%.
There's no fault in that. You have to, and I stress this in our day.
You can't not report that.
Any simple suspicion. It's then to me on the administrative side on how it was handled.
Yes, exactly.
That's where I get a little like, ugh.
Yes. Don't love how this whole thing was handled.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The devil is in the details, man.
Yes. Yes. I fully support why this was suspected as abuse and what they did. And and I even support the custody and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. I support all of that. How some of the details were handled with how the family was treated also as a parent, even if I was to be one that was ill.
Yes.
You know what I mean? You still, you can't do some of the things that you did. You can't do some of that. So, ugh. Well, I certainly can't wait to hear part three. Luckily, I only have to wait like an hour. You guys have to wait 2 weeks.
Yep.
Sorry. So thank you for listening, everybody. If you want to keep in touch with us, following us and checking us out and, you know, bearing with us when you might not agree with a part one, but then part two, you're like, okay,
just hang in there.
These girls
man.
Know what they're doing.
Please just hang in there.
You can find us on Facebook at Med Crimes Podcast.
You can search for us on YouTube, Med Crimes Podcast.
You can check us out on Instagram by searching Med Crimes Podcast.
If you wish to become a Patreon or a Irish whistleblowing hottie.
Banshees,
baby. Go to www.patreon.com/medcrimespodcast. It's fun.
It's fun.
There's free shit. It's great.
If you want to send us any ideas, comments, anything, you can reach out to us at medcrimes@gmail.com.
Stay safe out there.
Thanks for listening.